My name is Fred Niedner. I teach in a theology department at Valparaiso University in Indiana. And this is my third time to be out here at Holden. I've taught once before. Last year I was here just as a guest during the fires. It was an interesting... Were any of the rest of you here last summer? It was quite a curious experience to be in broad daylight and not be able to see the mountains because of the smoke. Having ashes falling on you all the time. Anyway, Foretaste of the Feast to Come is our theme this summer, and I'm going to be working on conventional visions of the Feast to Come and alternative visions of the Feast to Come. And by conventional visions of the Feast to Come, I mean the kind that our human nature would like to have, but the kind we're probably not going to get. And by alternative visions of the Feast to Come, I mean the ones that I think that people who follow the way of the cross should be working to fulfill and to hope for in this world. I am not going to start out immediately, though, on the subject, because I learned in my first stretch of teaching at Holden that it's good to begin in a slightly different way, and I will do this each day that I do the Bible study. When I was here the first time, somebody handed me a copy of the book of Charles Lutz's that gives the history of Holden Village, and one of the most instructive lines in that book to me was that a line from the former director of Holden, Elmer Witt, who said that one of the most important things about Holden is humor. And so, as not to get too serious, I always begin each little session here with just a bit of humor. And so I brought along some things that I have collected over the last month. Some of them are from my students at Valparaiso University who collect things off the internet and give them to me. One of the things that I brought along is perhaps most useful to those of you who may have been in the village for a while and not know the news from outside. What I brought along is the new daily schedule for the public broadcasting system that's in place now so as to stave off the attempts of Newt Gingrich and others to cut off their funding. Okay, so here's the new... This is the new PBS television schedule, which is supposed to help. 8 a.m. morning stretch. Arnold Schwarzenegger does squats while reciting passages of Atlas Shrugged. 9 a.m. Mr. Rogers' segregated neighborhood. King Friday sings Elitism is Neat. The House Un-American Activities investigation of Mr. McFeely continues. And Mr. Rogers explains why certain kids can't be his neighbor. 10 a.m., Sesame Street. Jerry Falwell teaches Big Bird to be more judgmental. Oscar the Grouch plays substitute for Rush Limbaugh. Bert and Ernie are kicked out of the military. And Jesse Helms bleaches all the Muppets white. 11 a.m., Square One, a MathNet episode, Ernest Does Trickle Down. Jim Varney explains how cutting taxes for the rich and spending more on defense will balance the budget. And on with all sorts of political things. 3 p.m., there's a nature item. Join James Watt and Charlton Heston as they use machine guns to bag endangered species. 5 p.m., the Newt Gingrich News Hour. Clarence Thomas and Bob Packwood present in-depth personal reports on sexual harassment. Pat Buchanan says he is being shut out from national exposure, and so forth. 8 p.m., Masterpiece Theater, Ibsen's A Dollhouse. Phyllis Schlafly adds to this classic with an added scene where Nora gladly gives up her independence while her husband chains her to the stove. 10 p.m., Adam Smith's Money World, How to Profit from Ozone Depletion. Finally, at 11 p.m., Insights of Dan Quayle. 11:01 p.m., sign off. So, those are some cheap shots, but that's what's happening out there in the world. One of the stories or scriptural texts that I find sort of foundational for understanding visions for the feast to come and our ways of hoping for them and our ways of trying to be a part of bringing them to fruition in the world is the story of the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. In Matthew chapter 4, I mistakenly told Deanne Lagerquist, who put the schedule up, that it's Matthew 3 because we were doing this up in her living room. Well, that's tomorrow. Tomorrow is Matthew 6. Today is Matthew 4, not Matthew 3, as it says on the kiosk. But if you stayed up all night studying Matthew 3, which I doubt, your time was not wasted, because Matthew 3 is very important for the understanding of Matthew 4. Matthew 3, at least the end of it, contains the story of Jesus' baptism, at which the voice from the heavens comes and says, it's in the last verse there of Matthew 3, "This is my Son, the Beloved, with whom I am well pleased." And then immediately, Jesus is led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. He fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and afterwards he was famished, and the tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God," which is what the voice has just said, of course, "if you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread." So the temptations follow hard on the baptism and Jesus' identification as the Son of God. Okay, if that's who you are, then let's figure out what that means. Because if you are the Son of God, certain things ought to happen. And let's get to them. Now, with my usual teaching, with the people in my usual teaching context, which are 18 to 22-year-olds, back in Indiana, I often need to remind them of all the little links there are in just these first verses to the rest of the biblical tradition, and to remind them that there is another major story in the Bible about people being out in the wilderness for 40 units of time and being hungry. And of course, that's the story of the wilderness wanderings of the people of Israel, about whom God has said to the Pharaoh back in Exodus, "Pharaoh, Israel is my firstborn son. Let my son go." And so ultimately, God's son Israel is released through God's intervention and launched into 40 years in the wilderness, where, as we will see shortly, Deuteronomy 8 anyway says, there God put Israel to the test to see what was in their hearts. Who would they be really when put to the test? And so, just in the same way, Jesus, named Son of God, is put into the wilderness and put to the test. Who would he be really? What would be in his heart? And the first question is, if, or not question, test, if you are who the voice says you are, command these stones to become loaves of bread. Now, what kind of temptation is this? I always thought, at least as a child and a young person, that a temptation was a temptation to do a bad thing, a temptation to do a sin. Now, what kind of sin would it be to change stones into bread? I am not aware of any piece of the Torah, any commandment that says, thou shalt not turn stones into other things. You know? I'm not aware of anything that says, thou shalt not eat the stones. So there's not, this is not a violation of some commandment. This is not, I don't believe, a temptation to do something wrong. I believe instead that it is a temptation to do a good thing. It is...
For the wrong reason.
Well, maybe that's the problem, that it's for the wrong reason, or that the timing is bad, or something. But it's certainly not unheard of that we have miraculous feedings in the wilderness. And, of course, it's not just God who fed the Israelites in the wilderness with manna. But Jesus will go on eventually in the wilderness to feed multitudes, not with stones, but almost. So this is a request to do not just a good thing, but to do something that is one of the great human dreams and one of the messianic dreams. Because one of the dreams for what will happen when the Messiah comes, or one of the promises for what will happen when the Messiah comes, is that there will be plenty. And in Judaism, in Jesus' day, one of the ways that the Messianic era was described was an era in which this time we will have manna once more, bread from heaven, but not just enough for today, but we will have abundance. There will be enough. There will be no more scarcity. So that's a great human dream, that we would have enough. And it's one of the promises of the tradition. And don't you think the world would be a different place if somebody could turn stones into bread, and not just into bread, but all the other things that we need and that we want? Then nobody would be in want anymore. We would have no more starvation in places of famine in the world. Nobody would have to fight anybody else ever again for stuff. We wouldn't have to hassle with the Japanese about trade wars. Well, there would just be enough for everybody. Enough bread, enough VCRs, enough cars, enough everything. No, we would never again have to hassle about stuff. That's a great human dream. So, if you are the Son of God, let's get beyond the stuff wars, and let's have no more want. Ann.
Yeah, but the issue is not, there probably is enough for everyone. The issue is not enough. It's the human condition seems to be we're never satisfied.
Yeah, and that's exactly one of the critiques we have to make of this dream. We have to ask, well, how much is enough? Is it possible to have enough?
The problem is, I think humans always want to have more than they have, and that others do.
Sure.
If there was enough to go around, certain people would want to go.
Yeah. Many, many people in this world would look at my house and my lifestyle and say, you got plenty. You got more than enough. But that's not what I think. there's several stuff I want, or many. Anyway, sure.
I see the question as one of appealing to Jesus' pride to try to trip him up, to do something to prove to Satan that he was who he is, says he is.
There's an element of that in all of these, yeah, but especially in the next one. All right, show us.
Yeah. My kids used to do. Are you really as tough as the other guys say you are? You want to fight back?
Yeah.
Prove it.
Yeah.
Isn't this a temptation to power? That's the other ones yet.
I think all of them are also that, the use of power, or the, they all have to do with the way that you would change the world, to into a different way. What power? By what power can you make the world right? Set the world right. Jesus' response to this is one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. The second part of that is only in Matthew. Luke is the other gospel that has all three of the temptations described, and in Luke, Jesus only says one does not live by bread alone. We'll get to the every word of the mouth of God a little bit later, because I think that's a response to all three of the temptations. But at least provisionally, or in a preliminary way, the point is that enough stuff wouldn't do it. And that we've already observed. Maybe we have enough now and it still doesn't solve the problem. We cannot envision any level of stuff that we could have that we would ever say, okay, now we have enough. Because we have hungers and cravings that stuff don't satisfy. Stuff doesn't satisfy, excuse me. For one thing, you can have all the stuff that you want, excuse me, and still not have what the voice from the heavens gave you, namely an identity and ultimate value as beloved of God. So those things that we crave for, a sense of value as human beings, a sense of being ultimately loved, and a sense of identity, those don't come from stuff. So you can have all the stuff that you want and not have those. So that's one shortcoming of the great human dream, that the world could be fixed by means of stuff. Oh, we'll come back to the rest of that later. Then the devil took him to the holy city, placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, saying, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it's written in Psalm 91, the devil goes on to quote. It's written in the Bible, and if you can't believe the Bible, what can you believe? He will command his angels concerning you. On his hands they will bear you up so that you will not dash your foot against a stone." Well, there is a certain foolishness to this temptation that doesn't complicate the other one. Of course, it's silly to think that you could stand on the Sears Tower and jump off and expect, "Okay, God, if you're for real, I'm falling." So in a very simple way, this could speak to the whole business of putting God to the test by doing outrageous things. And people have done that, and a lot of them aren't here to talk about it.
Don't we do a lot of foolish things in our lives that really are, and really do tempt?
Oh, of course.
Test God. I think of people, I don't just want to single out one thing, but people who cannot handle liquor who think they can and put their family in all sorts of danger, they, oh, it's okay, I can handle that. And not just that, I mean, there are many other things.
Sure.
And we get too close to the fire, you know, I'm not going to get burned. It's a kind of a foolish action on our part.
Yeah. I can drive too fast. I can I can do all sorts of things, and it'll be okay. And, well, a couple ways I see this as fulfillments of great human dreams. The simple one is, I think, it could be a temptation to fulfill the great craving that at least many people have for proof that God's promises are trustworthy and that God is for real. Haven't any of us wondered at some point in our lives, couldn't our lives be different if we just could be rid of doubts about, you know, God's faithfulness or God's existence even? You know, and if somebody could jump 400 and some feet from the pinnacle of the temple down to the Kidron Valley below, that's where they were standing, by the way, is on the part of the temple that was not just the wall of the temple, but the wall of the city, and they went straight down to the Kidron Valley, which separated the Mount of Olives from the mount on which Jerusalem stood. So that's a pretty fair leap. It's not quite the Sears Tower or the Empire State Building, but, you know, the ancient equivalent thereof. If somebody could leap from there and land on the street below and say, ta-da, see, it's all true, would that fix things for you? If you could witness that, would that help you? You would have proof that God is for real? It wouldn't help me a bit, because I know very well I would say, all right, I want to see the replay.
Do it again.
I want to have a slightly different angle this time. How does this work? I cannot imagine a sign that I could not question in that way. So I think the quest or the craving for proof is as insatiable as the craving for enough. But I think there's another way to look at this that makes it a bit more seductive. The Bible text that the devil actually quotes in Psalm 91 doesn't just say the angels will keep charge of you and so forth, but that they will keep you in all your ways. That is, as you go about your daily business, not just when you are tempted to leap from the temple, but when you're going about your daily routine, in all your ways, on their hands they will bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. So shouldn't you be able to expect, if you are the Son of God, if you're one of, if you belong to God, that, you know, maybe you don't necessarily have to have the capacity to fly from, you know, the pinnacle of the temple to the valley below, but you should be able to fly over other valleys that you come to in your life, like the valley of the shadow of cancer, or the valley of the shadow of car accidents, and the valley of the shadow of, you know, your kid being destroyed. So that nobody, it wouldn't have to ever happen that people would die at 14 of leukemia, or leave young children behind because of ovarian cancer at 33, or nobody would die in tragedies. But everybody the angels would see to it that everybody got their 70 years and 10 and died quietly in their beds with their grandchildren around them. That would be fair. That is a great human dream. And when the Messiah comes, that's what we'll have. The lamb can lie down with the lion, and the young child can sit next to an adder's nest, and those bad things won't happen. That's a great human dream. And one of the things that the scriptures themselves teach us to expect. So, if you are the Son of God, let's fly over all those human valleys. But Jesus says, again it is written, do not put the Lord your God to the test. Quoting again from Deuteronomy, this time from Deuteronomy 6, where the context is a reminder, Moses is reminding the people that they should not put God to the test as they did back at the incident in Exodus, where the first time they were thirsty in the wilderness, they began to complain and demand a reason for why they were out there and why they were thirsty. And ultimately, God provides water from a rock for them, but it's bitter water because they have put God to the test. And they got to one of those valleys, those human valleys, and they said, all right, God, you know, do something about this. And Jesus says, that doesn't work. So as inviting as that dream is a seduction. Finally, the devil took him to a very...
When people encounter real bad things in their lives and pray earnestly for relief, and put all their eggs in that basket, and then are disappointed. Is this a valid way for a pastor to counsel people like that? How do you deal with that? Is this a reasonable way to tell people that there are a lot of people out there who lose their faith in God? And are completely disheveled when bad things happen to them. And how do you deal with that? To try to put it in the context of the scriptures.
Yeah, I wouldn't use this story. I'd much more likely use Job. And not the beginning and ending of Job, but the middle, in which Job puts God on trial, puts God, as it were, to the test, and says, you know, why me? What's with your faithfulness, God, and so forth? And the friends all try and explain that there must be a reason for this, and this must be fair some way or another, or deserved. And God finally shows up at the end and says, among other things, you know, only Job spoke rightly here, and the rest of all these friends, get out of here because you've spoken. You haven't spoken the truth. And I use that as authorization for, in the face of suffering, in the face of feeling that promises have not been kept toward me, that it, you know, it's fine to cry out and get in God's face and be honest. On the other hand, I can't give a whole pastoral theology of this in a few minutes' time, but having said his piece to God about his pain, Job finally did what would be the best way to say this. I'm into something more complicated than I can get back out of easily. Job is a complicated example because if you take the beginning and the ending of Job, Job gets everything back. You know, everything's put right, and you know he's happy again. He doesn't get his 10 children back, but he gets others. But if you don't take that ending. Having had his chance to scream about his pain in the book of Job, God does listen to his screams and to his pain, and comes and sits with Job, and I guess that's what I would say to hurting people. Yes, you have every right to be angry and upset over this, and God can take that. God sits with us in our pain. I know that doesn't do justice to that whole question, but. Let's move on to the devil takes him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor and said to him, all these I will give you if only you fall down and worship me. Well, I think it's instructive to note what Jesus doesn't say here. He doesn't say, well, it's not yours to give. Jesus does not dispute the assumption that the devil makes that these things are his to hand out. I think this, too, is a great human dream that all the kingdoms of the earth would be in the control of some benign ruler under whose reign we could have peace. And the world has seen an incredible array of attempts to do that. As far back as Alexander the Great, people have attempted to conquer the world for the sake of having a world peace. I mean, that was Alexander the Great's great dream. He saw that human beings had so many different religions and languages and cultural systems that they were always going to fight and compete. And if they could have one language and one religion and one everything, they would be fine. So Alexander took over as much of the world as he could and said, all right, now we got one of everything. And it will be Greek, since I am Greek. Well, there has been this quest virtually forever that we could have one rule and peace. And of course, the Bible is full of visions of that too. And that's part of the messianic vision. There will finally be a world peace under the rule of God and God's chosen one, God's Messiah. The question is, how do you get that rule? By worshiping Satan, the devil, or some other way? Now, in the first century, at least the Christians and perhaps others did believe that the world was in the control of the devil. The book of Revelation says so. The book of Revelation says flat out that the world has been handed over to the devil for a long eon, 1,000 years. And only after that will God wrest control. So the world does belong to the devil. It is the devil's to give. And the question is, how do you get it back? I think we might well ask, well, what was the evidence that the world was in the devil's control? Who was controlling the world at that time?
Rome.
Yeah, Rome, the Roman Empire, controlled the world that these people knew about. And they lived under the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome. And how did Rome keep the peace? What kept that peace in place?
Power.
Terror.
Military occupation of power.
Sure. Sure. You do what we want, or we destroy you. It's simple as that. That's how we keep the peace. And every successful empire in the history of the world has operated the same way. Using force, keeping peace by means of fear, and for the sake of gain. That's the way it works. And it's possible to read the great messianic visions of the Bible itself as promising that very way of attaining the peace. The great visions of, you know, the last chapters of Zechariah, which are so informative of much of the New Testament, they all say that when God comes to put things right, what will happen is, first of all, God will destroy all those peoples who have been picking on Israel and picking on Jerusalem. And God will stomp on the Moabites and the Edomites and the Ammonites and all the other ites and set up rule in Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the nations will then flow into Jerusalem. Even some of those wonderful texts that we learned as kids when we were the ones in the Christmas pageants on Christmas Eve, and we would recite our messianic predictions, "But thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah," and the ones from Isaiah about he shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. But if you keep on going, what it says is that he's going to stomp on the Philistines until the blood of their babies squishes up between his toes. But we didn't memorize that part for Christmas. You know. Those visions are all militaristic visions, in which the ites are going to pay someday, and we will rule. That is Satan's way, to rule by means of power and fear and for the sake of gain. And this temptation, I think, is to admit that that's the only way it can be done. There is no other way. And so, if you are the Son of God, take over. And there were many in Jesus' day who were calling for that. And many who rejected him, ultimately rejected him because, hey, the Romans were still here. And the ites are still picking on us. And so he can't have been the Messiah because the promises have not come true. But Jesus says, no, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. So there must be another way besides the conventional way to bring peace by means of power and the use of fear. There must be some other way to have enough and to handle the valleys of life that we can fall into. Here's where I like to go back now to the first response of Jesus, the one in verse 4. It's written, one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. That's from Deuteronomy 8. So let's flip back to Deuteronomy 8. Moses, Deuteronomy is Moses' farewell speech as it's presented to us. He is at the end of the book of Deuteronomy going to be taken off to die without seeing the promised land and to be buried by God. And at the brink of entering the promised land, Moses makes this enormously long farewell speech. in which he recapitulates the entire law that the people are to be observant of and gives them a whole new law. That's what Deuteronomos means, a second law for how they shall live in the land. This entire commandment that I command you today, and he's referring now to the recapitulation of the whole law that was given at Sinai, you must diligently observe so that you may live and increase and go in and occupy the land that the Lord promised on oath to your ancestors. Remember the long way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness in order to humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commandments. So there's the test, you know, the same test that Jesus has endured. What is really in your heart? Whose are you really? He humbled you by letting you hunger, then by feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your ancestors were acquainted with, in order to make you understand that one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Or my Bible has a footnote that says you could also translate that by anything that the Lord decrees. I reviewed the Hebrew over here in the library yesterday, and literally the Hebrew says, you do not live on bread alone, but you live on everything that the mouth of God causes to come forth, which could be understood a lot of different ways. Because what comes forth from the mouth of God in the Hebrew way of thinking is not just words, but the word for words in Hebrew is also the word for deeds. So God's word is God's deed. And so this is a kind of an ambiguous, not kind of, a very ambiguous text. We do not live by bread alone, but by everything that God brings forth. Everything the mouth of God brings forth. Well, let's keep going because there is a feast coming. Please notice, Moses goes on, the clothes on your back did not wear out, and your feet did not swell these 40 years. Know then in your heart that despite everything that's happened, as a parent disciplines a child, so the Lord your God disciplines you. Keep the commandments. For the Lord, verse 7, the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land flowing with streams, springs, underground waters, welling up in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, vines and fig trees, pomegranates, olive trees, honey, a land where you may eat bread without scarcity, where you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and from whose hills you may mine copper, you may eat your fill. And bless the Lord your God for the good land he has given you. So the feast is coming. You know. That's the word of God. Or that's a word of God. The feast, you are coming to the feast. God will give it to you.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Also, is this a feast that will be coming for Jesus, but in his state now of utter of humiliation, and that he's going through suffering, that the glory will come after his death, resurrection, and ascension, mm-hmm. that he's passing through a famine just as we may have to pass through difficult times in life?
I think we can assume, given the way that all the Gospels are written, that what it means to be a follower of Jesus is to have everything that happens to Jesus happen also to us. I mean, this journey will be our journey. We can count on the wilderness. Yeah.
He knew the hunger that a lot of people are going through. I look at that 40 days, and I cannot imagine how difficult, except when I went through some surgery, and they couldn't give me water for I don't know how many days. And then they started with a half a cup of ice, a little. They dole it out to me every half hour.
Mm-hmm.
I'm waiting for Aurora to come with that half a cup of ice. And I tell her, turn that cup upside down. I want to be sure you get all of it. And it was just an unbelievable obsession and need. And I think I may have been without some water for maybe 10 or 12 days. Mm-hmm. 40 days without food. That would be a physical temptation for Jesus. If he was tempted in all things, as we are, the idea of a piece of bread sounded pretty good. By the way, I like the bread they make up here at Holden. That's good stuff.
I was thinking, this sounds like Holden, and from whose hills you will dig copper.
Yes. Yeah. I think we need to read a little more of Deuteronomy 8 to get the full impact, and then I do want to throw it open because there's certainly lots of loose ends that are nowhere near tied up here. Verse 12. Well, let's keep going with 11. Take care that you do not forget the Lord your God by failing to keep his commandments. When you have eaten your fill, when you have had the feast, and have built fine houses and live in them, and your herds and flocks have multiplied, as have your silver and your gold, and everything you have. Then do not exalt yourself, forgetting the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness, and made water flow for you from the rock, fed you in the wilderness with manna. Do not say to yourself, my power and the might of my own hand have gotten me this wealth, but remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, so that he may confirm his covenant that he swore to your ancestors. Now, I see a lesson about feasting here, but I don't want to impose it on everybody. I would go back to something Ann said. There is enough in this world, probably. But isn't it possible that a lot of us, or a lot of people in the world, forget that everything that we have is a gift? And we are so tempted to say, well, I got mine. I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. And I got enough for myself by my hard work. Now let those other people do the same thing. If we could really keep completely attuned to the sense of the gift nature of all the stuff of every conceivable kind that we have, could there maybe be the feast for everybody? Enough for everybody. So is it possible that what inhibits the feast is forgetfulness of the gift quality of everything? I mean, that's one set of things that comes to my mind. I've also been thinking about that last temptation to bring peace. And what are the other possibilities for how you could bring peace if not through conventional means, if not through force, then through what? If we superimpose Jesus' response to the first temptation to the third one, does it help to think that maybe we don't live by force, but by the word? Is it possible that there are words rather than guns that could make the peace? And what might those words be?
And then if you said that the in Hebrew the word and deed are the same, so if there are words that we can use, then what are the deeds that
doesn't seem to me that Jesus is actually promising peace, and the devil's working toward that concept, but Jesus never says that follow my way, we're going to have peace. The only thing he says is you got to worship me and only serve me. He doesn't say that's coming to peace.
Yeah.
Because it hasn't worked so far.
Yeah. I was reading that last response of Jesus, the response to the third temptation as, don't use anybody else's way but God's way to rule the world, to make peace. Satan's way will make a kind of peace, or the devil's way will make a kind of peace, but it will be the Pax Romana in some form or another. I was reading it as though there is an assumption that God's way would make for a different kind of peace. And it hasn't worked yet. You're exactly right. And what I'm trying to struggle for is, what is God's way of making the peace? If you look at the life of Jesus, I mean, what does Jesus go on to do? He doesn't, I mean, well, excuse me, he does do a lot of these things. He does feed people in the wilderness. He does raise a few people from the valley of the shadow of death. The widow's son at Nain, Jairus' daughter.
But when we're talking about there is enough, you know, that is not bread alone, we have to go a step further. If we're talking about bread as satisfying our physical needs, there's another step further than that. We have to take care of too. Like, we don't be of good cheer and then walk by to someone that's hurting.
Yeah.
And say, well, God's peace be with you, and leave them hurting or hungry or whatever. There's a dimension beyond physical satisfaction that we have to be concerned about. We have to have bread, you know, we have to satisfy, like you say, mm-hmm. you know. But I mean, we can't just stop there.
Well, didn't Jesus say, your heavenly Father knows that you have need of all of these things? I was thinking about when the people followed Jesus after he fed the multitudes. And they followed him over to the other side of the lake. And they said, oh, are you here? He said, well, you followed me not because you believe the things that I'm saying, but because I fed you and you had all you wanted to eat. And you were filled. I think he's making an allusion to then he talks about, I am the bread of life. But that dimension of faith and trust in him is, and living out your life in him, and him in you, is that which really, really satisfies. That does not take away from our responsibility to serve the Lord our God with all our heart, mind, and everything. Mm-hmm. And in that way, I think we can alleviate some of the hunger and create some of the peaceful conditions in this world. We can make a dent in it. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking more of what Jesus said there, that he had the bread of life for us. That, sure, we need the bread. We need all the Social Security. But you need a lot more than that mm-hmm. to really be happy.